It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, and on the show today, natural intelligence. And we're going to kick things off by going back in time to the 1750s. And a marshy, swampy, subtropical wetland in North Carolina, where a man named Arthur Dobbs lived.
Yeah, no, I like Arthur Dobbs.
This is our tour guide, Greg Gage.
He was the governor of North Carolina. This is back in the 1750s, still under British rule.
And Arthur, he says, was a curious man, a bit of a gentleman scientist. So when Arthur started to hear a rumor about a very unusual plant growing not that far away, he decided to go check it out.
And he heard these stories about this plant. He says, well, I'm the governor of this land. I should go investigate. He went out to the swamps. And so there's a little small area. I think it's about 6 square miles. And then there, low to the ground, are these little tiny plants. And that if you watch them long enough, a bug will eventually fall into its little, or walk across its little leaves. And it snaps shut and it eats this bug. And so, of course, he's pretty fascinated by this.
Understandable because, well, no Europeans had ever documented a plant like this before. So
he does what scientists do at the time. They take out a letter and they write to their colleagues in Europe.
The great wonder of the vegetable kingdom is a very curious unknown species of sensitive.
He writes, it's a dwarf plant. Leaves are like a narrow segment of a sphere consisting of two parts, like the cap of a spring purse.
Upon anything touching the leaves or falling between them, they instantly close like a spring trap. To this surprising plant, I've given the name of fly trap sensitive.
The fly trap sensitive, or as we call it today, the Venus fly trap. The news of this remarkable animal-eating plant took off across Europe. And 100 years later, Charles Darwin would write an entire book called Insectivorous Plants.
Eventually, the great Charles Darwin got to study this plant, and this plant absolutely blew him away. He called it the most wonderful plant in the world.
Here's Greg Gage on the TED stage.
This is a plant that was an evolutionary wonder. This is a plant that moves quickly, which is rare. And it's a plant that's carnivorous, which is also rare. And it's in the same plant. But I'm here today to tell you that's not even the coolest thing about this plant. The coolest thing is that the plant can count.
So let's pause for a moment. Greg Gage is not just an amateur flytrap historian. He is actually a neuroscientist and educator. And on the TED stage, he conducted a live science experiment.
So I'm going to pretend to be a fly right now.
Surrounded by monitors, microscopes, and of course, plants.
And now here's my Venus flytrap. And inside the leaf, you're going to notice that there are three little hairs here. And those are trigger hairs. And so when a fly lands, I'm going to touch one of the hairs right now.
Attached to the fly trap, EKG sensors, measuring any electrical signals generated by the plant.
Ready? 1, 2, 3.
And there, the monitor lit up as Greg grazed the hairs inside the fly trap.
What do we get? We get a beautiful action potential. However, the fly trap doesn't close.
That's because it's waiting to see if it gets touched again within 20 seconds or so. Venus flytraps don't want to be hasty for several reasons.
Number one is that it takes a long time to open the traps back up, you know, about, you know, 24 to 48 hours if there's no fly inside of it. And so it takes a lot of energy. And number two, it doesn't need to eat that many flies throughout the year. It only needs to eat a handful. It gets most of its energy from the sun. It's just trying to replace some nutrients in the ground with the flies. And the third thing is it only opens, then closes the traps a handful of times until that trap dies. So therefore, it wants to make really darn sure that there's a meal inside of it before this flytrap snaps shut. So how does it do that? It counts the number of seconds between successive touching of those hairs. I'm going to touch the Venus flytrap again. I've been talking for more than 20 seconds. And then if I'm a fly moving around, I'm going to be touching the leaf a few times. I'm going to go and brush it a few times. And immediately, the flytrap closes. So here we're seeing the flytrap actually doing a computation.
I mean, that sounds like this plant is pretty smart.
Yeah, it's well, I mean, it definitely is competing. I always think that plants are kind of cool because, you know, humans, if there's a rough situation, we can just run away, right? Or we can just kind of like get out of Dodge. But these plants are stuck there. Right? They're in the ground, right? And so they've got nothing to do except for try to feed themselves somehow. They come up with a very incredible ways of doing that.
We hear a lot about the powers of artificial intelligence. But all around us, nature continues to find extraordinary ways to survive and communicate that we are still just beginning to understand. So today on the show, natural intelligence. New findings about the brilliance of dragonflies, our immune system, and whales, and how they are influencing human behavior. First, though, back to Greg Gage. He brought another surprisingly sensitive plant onto the TED stage.
The mimosa, not the drink, but the mimosa pudica.
Greg, during your stage experiment, you also had this other plant that kind of looks like a fern, and it's called a mimosa.
And this is a plant that's found in Central America and South America, and it has behaviors.
And you just lightly touch the leaves, and it kind of like wilted away from you.
If I tap the leaf, the entire branch seems to fall down.
And my dad actually had a mimosa plant when I was a kid, and I was fascinated by this response. Like, I would touch it, and it would pull away from me. Like, get off me, you know?
Yeah, so it's actually very, very similar to humans, right? So there's like a touch receptor, just like we do in our skin. And then when we press down on something, we feel it because an electrical impulse is being sent back up to our brains, and we interpret that impulse as the feeling of touch. Inside of this leaf, very similar cells are within there that will send an electrical current. Only this time, it instead of using muscles, it again uses water. It flushes the water out and makes the plant move.
But why? Is it always about survival?
I suspect so. Yeah, and it's funny because with the mimosa, there's a couple of theories of why. You know, if an animal brushes past it, it doesn't look as... I mean, looking at mine right now, they don't look very tasty, right? Maybe I would eat a different plant if I saw that one. Or maybe it kind of freaks out some insects that would want to land on it. That's a learning mechanism they can do, but that's kind of boring compared to some other experiments that have been done. Experiments where you can take a pea pod and you let it grow in the dark. You have a little tube that goes up and it kind of goes like a Y. It's called a bifurcated tube. And if you shine a light in one of the tubes, say on the right side, and you blow a fan on the other one, you can do this protocol where you blow the fan on the left and then you shine the light on the right. And then the next day, you blow the fan on the right, you shine the light on the left. Each day it's kind of growing up this tube, trying to get to that top of it, right? And then on the experiment day, right when it's about to make a decision, you flip it again, but you only blow the fan. And then you ask the question, which way will the plant grow? Will it grow where it last saw the light, which would make sense, right? Or did it figure out the relationship between the fan and the light and grow to where the light would have been if it's going to come on soon, right? You get a majority of the plants that kind of figure it out. They kind of figure out that they have to go in the other direction and go away from where it last saw the light, but where the fan was indicating where we go. And to me, that's kind of flexible. And then that's starting to show some decisions, right? That's starting to show a little bit of intelligence. So it's the ones that made it are the ones that can sort of live on to tell the story, right? And so then those genes get inherited and move forward.
So we have covered plants, which seem like a more simple life form than, say, mammals, yet kind of display some very seriously smart behavior. But you are also really interested in, seems strange to say this, but you're really excited about slime mold, which is not a plant, but...
No, but a mold is a cell, right? A slime mold is a single cell. They kind of sit in a petri dish and you feed them little oats. And they kind of wrap around it and they kind of suck up the nutrients and they kind of can go dormant for many, many years and they can come back alive again. And
wow.
Yeah, they're absolutely fascinating. But they're
you can see them, though, stages. Even though they're single cells?
They can be a single cell could be like, you know, a meter long. They could be big. So they're macro. Huh. And so we were doing an experiment. One of the experiments we did was we put a piece of food in there. We watched how often would it go towards the food. And not surprisingly, it goes towards the food a lot, right? But slime molds are kind of they don't want to be dried out. So they don't like sunlight. And so if you shine a light there, you know, then they will shy away from it. They'll try to go around it, but they won't go through they try not to go through the light. That would make sense if it was an animal. You're like, okay, well, their eyes are seeing it. The eyes are sending the message back to the brain, and the brains are telling the muscles which way to go. But then you realize, well, wait a minute, there's no brain, right? There's no, it's just cells, right? So they have these sensors on the outside of the cell that's sending back information, but that information is being processed inside the cell itself. And so I think there's a lot to be said about the cell. I mean, the cell is basically a little computer. It's got a little Turing machine inside of it, and it has goals, right? It tries to do things, and so and it has a lot of things and its resources to be able to do.
I recently went to a lecture about the crows that are the only birds that we know that use or fashion and then use tools.
Oh, corvids, yeah.
They're amazing. And just every so often you hear this incredible story that shouldn't blow our minds, but does, about how the natural world is so incredibly smart. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, should it expand our definition of intelligence? How in simple terms, how do we define what intelligence is?
Yeah, I think the simplest way, given what you got, right, you got to figure out how to be able to get to what you want, right? And so that's kind of my kind of the back of the envelope sketch of intelligence, is being able to get to what you want given what you have. And that's what intelligent things do. You look at a dog trying to get through a door, it'll kind of go check the other doors. It's trying to figure out what it needs to do. And so you can look at these plants as, you know, in the case of these plants that are trying to find the light, they're taking what the information they have to figure that out. You know, you can look at single cells doing that. So I think the joy of intelligence is really in every living thing. I think every cell is intelligent. I think everything that comes from cells is intelligent.
That's Greg Gage. He's a professor at the University of Michigan and co-founder of Backyard Brains, a company that builds neuroscience experiments for kids. You can find all his talks at TED.com. On the show today, natural intelligence. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. We'll be right back.